Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, a founder that is joining us. We're going to be talking about big pivots. We're going to be talking about the journey of raising money. I mean, on their end, they've raised $175 million. Also, we're going to be talking about the team, you know, what really has been some of the core principles behind their culture that has made them push for, you know, as far as they've been pushing, you know, now for over 11 years, you know, and counting. And again, the whole building, scaling, financing. Also, she was part of this amazing startup too, right out of MIT, you know, that ended up getting acquired by Oracle. So, you know, this founder has seen it all, you know. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Christine Spang. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro. It's really great to be here today.
So Christine, originally born in Canada. But you were not long, you know, there. You know, once you turned 3 years old, it was time to pack the bags and come, you know, to upstate New York. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Yeah, for sure. Weirdly, I do still have a fair amount of memories of being in Canada because my family would go back every spring break for a long time. And so I'd like meet all the people that I like had lived on the same street as. But, you know, I was born in Scarborough at Scarborough General Hospital, which is like, if you talk to people in Toronto today, they're like, oh, Scarberia, that's like way on the outskirts. That's not really real Toronto. But that's, I think, you know, my parents were immigrants. Both of them are from Norway, moved when they were, in my mother's case, you know, in her like tweens. And with my dad, he came as an adult, but still pretty young. And, you know, I think it was, I remember, you know, having like a little sort of one-story house. I remember sometimes going to the bluffs over Lake Ontario, the Scarborough Bluffs. And apparently this is like really bougie now. And like when I lived there, it was like not bougie at all. But I can understand why like having this cliff that like looked over Lake Ontario, you know, might eventually attract people with money. And then I guess when I moved to upstate New York, I don't have like super strong memories of that, but I remember living in like a little apartment building with like no furniture at first. And then my parents bought a house kind of in the suburbs. And, you know, the reason that we moved was because my dad got a job at this company called Welch Allyn, which is a medical device maker. He was an electrical engineer and he'd actually previously worked for my grandpa, but my grandpa made him promise that he would not leave Canada and like stay close to the family until my grandpa retired. Cause you know, I think they wanted to have that connection. And my dad just like always like really believed in kind of the American dream and believed that America was like the land of opportunity and always wanted to get there. But you know, he had to sort of slow roll it in order to make my mom's family happy. So when my grandpa retired, that's when we were free to move and went to upstate New York for this good job for my dad. Came from a pretty big family. I have three siblings, two sisters, and a twin brother. And just generally growing up, spent a lot of time outside. You know, my suburban house like had a big backyard with a bunch of woods behind it. And like we built tree houses and like made slingshots and got into trouble.
That's always the way it is. But I guess in your case, you know, when you were in high school, that was the time where you actually, you know, discovered open source and, you know, that kind of like pushed you even farther into the whole computer science, you know, that you would explore more deeper, you know, as you went to college and you went to MIT. So what was that moment like when you're like, my God, this is fascinating. And that journey that you embarked of really discovering, you know, also computer science.
Yeah, for sure. I was always into kind of like science and math. And I always had this idea, like, I'm going to be some sort of engineer and I'm going to build things when I grow up. But that's like a super broad area, you know, like engineering, like, well, I mean, are you going to build bridges? Or are you going to, you know, sit at a computer and sort of make things from bits? So, you know, really, it didn't kind of centered down on sort of software until I sort of, you know, in addition to like running around outside, I also like read a lot of books. I was really into sci-fi and fantasy. I really had this like lust for adventure, you know, growing up in the suburbs. It's like very boring and safe. It's a great place to be a little kid. But, you know, as a teenager, you start getting restless. And I kind of channeled that, you know, with the mind, I would say. And I got into sort of these online adventure games called multi-user dungeons or domains, where it's like all text-based and you sort of create a character in a world and you get to explore. And I kind of gravitated towards like whatever world and game had like the fewest constraints possible, because I really wanted to be able to sort of create a story and create my own story. So I got really into this Lord of the Rings themed MUD, and eventually I started helping run it. And then as a part of helping run it, you know, the game had tools that you could, you know, create rooms and, you know, all those sorts of parts of the world and objects and things. But if you wanted to change the actual game mechanics and like add things to like what you could do in the game, you had to learn to code. So the game was written in the C programming language, which is not an easy language to learn. But I decided when I was, you know, like 15 years old that like I needed to learn C, because that would open up this ability to make changes to this game that I was like really, really into. And I deeply remember reading this book. It's like a classic book for C programming called A Book on C. And I remember reading the pointer section over and over again. And, you know, if you're someone who knows computers and software and these sort of older languages, you know, pointers and memory management are like kind of a hard topic to grok. And I just have like these strong memories of just being so confused about pointers until like I read it so many times and talked to a bunch of people, and eventually it really clicked. So that basically through that, the game also only ran on Linux. So I had to basically install Linux on the family computer. And my uncle was a software engineer in sort of the Linux ecosystem. So that's sort of how I got the connection to Linux. And this all just sort of like grew, and I kind of followed my curiosity. I started contributing to the actual Linux operating system that I was using to run the game. And through this process of discovery, I just learned and decided that like MIT was my dream school, because it was like a place where open source software came from and was invented. And it was just sort of this shining castle in my mind. And I also watched the movie Good Will Hunting, you know, where Matt Damon like is, you know, a janitor at MIT and like turns out to be a brilliant mathematician. And I think that was like honestly one of the things that led me to actually apply to MIT. I was like terrified of applying. I was like, this is like way out of my league. Like, there's no way that I can get in here. But basically the support of somebody who I'd met through contributing to Debian Linux, and then this movie and my friends in high school, I just sort of like shot my shot and got into MIT.
So what was that journey like of being at MIT, and most importantly, getting into the world of startups, into the venture world? Because that's ultimately the exposure that MIT gave you.
Yeah, it was honestly something that I would say was really good for me. It was the first place I really felt like I had found my people. You know, I had a bunch of kind of music geek friends in high school, and, you know, that was probably the first time I really had a group of friends. But when I got to MIT, like, kind of everybody who goes to MIT is like a super nerd. And I just felt really welcomed and encouraged, and like, you know, all the weird things that I did weren't like weird things, like they were good things, and that it was kind of cool to be into the things that I was into. You know, the flip side is also like a really intense experience. You know, it's a place where everybody shows up. They were the smartest person in their school. And then you get there and you're not the smartest person, and like the classes are way harder, and you have to actually work really hard in order to succeed. So it was pretty intense. You know, I had to learn a lot about myself and just like, you know, taking care of myself as like an adult, not at home, eating good food, making sure you can get sleep. And through that, a few things happened. Like, one is that I got involved in essentially the computer club at MIT, and I met a bunch of folks there who were working on this first is technology and then a company called CasePlace, which basically was a product and service around Linux and being able to update the sort of core part of Linux, the kernel, without having to fully restart and reboot the computer. And so this company took the tech that the founders had basically built as their graduate thesis and commercialized it in a security update service for any computer that was running Linux. And then probably the best place they had product market fit was amongst like web hosters, VPSs, things like that, where they would use this service to keep those machines up to date in a timely fashion, because most of the time when you get hacked, there's a patch already out there, just like it hasn't been applied. So I knew these folks, and actually I had been sponsoring software uploads for one of the founders to Debian Linux, because I'd gotten into that in high school and I had the ability to make uploads. I was an official sort of part of that project. And he had some math software that he wanted to get into the archive officially. So I was doing that for one of the founders. And then he happened to mention that, like, oh, you know, we're looking for interns. Like, you know, do you want a job? And I was like super curious, because there aren't that many startups that are like MIT spinouts, or at least they weren't, you know, 15 years ago when I was there. And it was just sort of like, there was like some hype around it internally, especially like amongst the computer science students. So I instantly said yes. And so I started working there part-time during my senior year, for basically the second half of my senior year. And then I came to the crossroads where I had to decide, do I stay and go to grad school, or they gave me a job offer to join full-time. And I had never been like super passionate about the idea of staying in academia. Like I just sort of like had this sense that like the place for me is in like applications and like applying techniques and not discovering new ones. You know, I just think I work best in like a team, and I'm like very practical, and I like don't thrive in an environment where you have to like not see the results of your work for a really, really long period of time. So I had been thinking about sticking around for a master's degree, but it was a really easy decision for me when I had the job offer to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go and get paid to do something and to build something.
And tremendous, tremendous education too, because I mean, you joined the CasePlace and CasePlace ended up getting acquired by Oracle not long after you had joined them, you know, all in all, like we're talking about like a year and a half, 2 years. I guess, how was that journey too for you of being able to experience the full cycle of a company from formation all the way to exit? You know, what kind of visibility did that give you?
Yeah, it was kind of like a sort of a speed run startup education. You know, it was a specific kind of company. They actually didn't raise any venture money. They had, you know, some competitions they won, some government grants, but it was totally bootstrapped and it was like run really scrappy. Like everybody worked in like the founder's house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, you know, we had like all the servers running in the basement and like cables, you know, running to each floor so that we could get enough power for our build servers in the basement. And, you know, we had to basically earn all the money that we were spending in order to grow the business. So it was really interesting for me to see, like, you know, when we first hired a couple salespeople and how you kind of like evaluate salespeople, and just in general, the operational piece of like kind of rigorously running a company. I think, you know, one of the CasePlace's teams just huge strengths was like how the founding team worked together and sort of split up responsibilities and then just like ran a really tight ship. And they kind of had to, because it was a bootstrap company, you know, you didn't have money to waste. And then, you know, just seeing how they like evaluated what is the potential trajectory of this company and like thinking about opportunity costs of, you know, basically they sold the company to Oracle because, you know, it felt like they could double the current business, but like they weren't sure how they could like 10x it or 1000x it. And so like having a reasonable acquirer that could like make really good use of the technology and have a good exit for them so that they could go on and go and do something else was actually a really great outcome for everybody. So, you know, I joined Oracle, got to go through the M&A process. Like, I think Oracle has like one M&A process for every company they've ever bought, from Sun Microsystems down to Caseflice, which at the time that was acquired was 15 people. And it was like crazy, just a lot of paperwork.
Just like the perfect assembly line. But for you, as they say, was the vesting and resting to a certain degree, because you started to get pitched again by the founders of Caseflice to join them on their next business. And then also, you know, you got pitched by another friend of yours, which ended up being the one that you ended up joining and going across the country. So why did you decide to go with this other friend and also, you know, moving across the country? That sounds a little like a big bet.
Yeah. So, you know, at this point in my life, I was 24. I'd stuck around. The Caseflice was based in Boston, Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, you know, that's where I went to school. I wanted to see Boston and just experience the area while I wasn't being crushed by an MIT undergraduate education. But I did that. You know, a lot of people that I knew had moved away, and I kind of felt like I either needed to double down and like build new community in the local area, or I could just go do something else. And, you know, this was 2013. The sort of Silicon Valley buzz was very intense at the time. And I like to use this test when sort of making big life decisions of like, imagine, you know, when you're like 80 plus years old and you're reflecting back at your life and you're thinking like, what would I regret, or what would I have regretted not doing? And I didn't really feel super attracted to like all of the crazy things that I heard about that were happening in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. But when I thought about looking back on my life and imagining not going and seeing what was going on there up front in person, you know, at a young age, it really felt like something that I would regret not going and trying and sort of seeing it. And it's really funny because I arrived, you know, moved across the country. I owned hardly anything. Like, all my stuff fit in one big suitcase, and I actually had to like remove some stuff from it at the airport because it was overweight, and I stuffed it in a pillowcase and I like brought that on the plane with me. And I'd gotten upgraded to first class, which seemed like a sign, but I was like in first class and I had this pillowcase full of stuff, including a Vitamix blender. Which I don't know why they let me on the plane with that. It definitely has a blade in it, but it's not very accessible. And I just, you know, shoved that like in under the seat in front of me. But like within 2 years of moving to the Bay, like all my friends were like, I can't believe you thought you wouldn't like it here. Like, you were like made for the Bay, you know, it's full of like crunchy granola hippies who like love being outside and getting up early and like daytime dance parties and tech. And like, it's just like basically all the things that I find really supportive and interesting in my life. And I'm really glad I did it. Obviously, you know, it worked out.
So then what happened next, you know, with your co-founder to get going here?
Yeah. So I showed up at his house after moving here. And like, I think for him, it was like, kind of like the first moment that made it real, you know, like he'd been like sort of like working on it on this on the side. Well, doing some like contracting work, but like when you're like working on something alone, like you can like feel like you're just like in this bubble of like fantasy land. Like, we're like, am I really doing this? But then like when I like show up with my laptop, like at his doorstep, you know, it's like, oh, I guess we're actually doing this. We're actually building a company. So, you know, the first few months we didn't have any money. We just basically had an idea, and the idea was basically there's a lot of really valuable data locked up in email, but people aren't connecting that data to other apps and making use of it because it's just too hard to access. There's like technical barriers to getting at that data and connecting it to other apps. But I got to say, like in the beginning, like just describing what we were trying to do was like not that simple. Like our elevator pitch started out was like 3 hours long of just like grinding people down, trying to put into words like this thought about like, you know, what in retrospect is like communications data is like conversations, interactions between people, like in a workplace. That's like where all the context exists. That's like how work gets done. You know, people communicate, they're working together. There's various artifacts of that. Maybe it's, you know, email threads. Maybe it's, you know, meetings that happen, the contents of those meetings. Maybe it's documents that get put together. But, you know, all of this like written information is like the context of a business and the context of work. And I think you just have to like start from the vagueness and like create concreteness. And like, that's like a process of like essentially like making your idea sort of get refined through contact with reality, because sometimes you can't find the words for something until you like try a bunch of words that don't work.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then I guess at what point, you know, were you guys like, hey, I think that we are into something here. It's kind of working with Nylos.
Yeah. So it's kind of like a bunch of different parts of the journey. We managed to raise like a little bit of seed funding just sort of based off of, you know, two MIT grads, an idea, like throw something at the wall, see what happens. And so we managed to like hire a couple friends and start, you know, giving everyone ramen salaries as a part of that. And we just started building. I think kind of the first thing that was like a sign of like, yeah, there's something here, was that we first built basically the first version of that API infrastructure we ended up building. We released as an open source product, and we did a bunch of PR about it. We released it on GitHub, and then we like basically worked hard to get an article on Hacker News, just like, you know, this website that a lot of software people like to get their news from. And just like seeing the engagement with like basically this like thesis news article, you know, get an article in TechCrunch, like put the software out there and just like see like what is the reaction. And it was like a really positive reaction. We got a lot of engagement, and that sort of told us like, keep going, you know, there's something here. So the next step was kind of refining that all the way into a product. And there was a bunch of twists and turns as a part of this refinement. Like, you know, we built this API infrastructure, but originally, the idea in terms of where the product was going was we were going to build this like email app, and the email app, it was like a desktop app, was going to be like where everything happened. Like, people were going to build these extensions into the email app, but that was kind of like where all of the user experience was going to be. Long story short, like, so we built the API infrastructure to power the app, but long story short is like, you know, the email app itself ended up being sort of like a path to nowhere. It's really hard to build an email app that people will pay for. You know, people are used to this being something that's subsidized by all the big tech players out there. And then kind of the bar for like features of that app is like really high. And then, you know, this whole thesis around people were going to build essentially like productivity extensions into that app to do like customer support or sales or whatever in our app ended up just being totally wrong. Like what we found out as a part of that was that like people don't want to sort of outsource their end-to-end user experience to someone else and like be a part of someone else's app. What they want is to like build really great experiences in their apps that they have control over that drives engagement to their app. And so we basically spent 4 years kind of building the foundation to this infrastructure. And then we, you know, started selling that. And then we also like built this whole desktop app that at the end of the day, we had to go through like a major pivot away from, because we were like hemorrhaging money running this app. There's like super high churn and like, it just like was obviously not something that was going to grow into a scalable business. So we ended up having to shut it down to kind of spin it off. It's like its own open source project now today. And we really refocused on the part of the business that was working, which was this API infrastructure that had powered the app, that all of these developers that we were targeting could just use the infrastructure to build, to pull in this communications data into their own apps and experiences and use that features to drive more engagement and to provide compelling functionality in the apps that, you know, they own kind of like the full user experience on. So, you know, it was definitely like sort of really existential experience of like, you know, if we keep going down this path, we're going to run out of money. And like, you know, it doesn't seem like it's working.
So then obviously, you know, you guys take action and obviously, you know, turn it around. So I guess for the people that, and the rest is history. So for the people that are listening, you know, to get it, what ended up being the business model of Nylas? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so the way that we make money is that, you know, we're an API infrastructure company, kind of like Stripe or Plaid. We sit between applications and kind of like the low-level cloud infrastructure that people use to like just build software in the cloud today. What that means is that we essentially have built all these integrations into these communications data providers, all of the email providers, all of the calendar providers. And what people use, I guess we also build sort of components of the user experience that are customizable that correspond to workflows that we found that people just need to build repetitively. And the reason that people use Nylas is so that they can go to market more quickly. We essentially provide this infrastructure that allows people to not worry about table stakes functionality that they have to build in order to make a competitive app. But, you know, it's not something that differentiates their app from other people out there. Everybody needs connections to this data. Everybody needs things like embedded scheduling. They need to pull in email context. You know, if they're building kind of CRM apps, business productivity apps, there's this kind of whole horizontal space. Today, AI agents are something that needs access to all of this context data in order to kind of personalize and contextualize what those agents are doing, what actions they're suggesting. And so we're kind of this like middleware layer that accelerates people's development and then also makes it so that they just have less operational load over time, because my team is the experts on email connectivity. We're the experts on sort of all of the intricacies around how calendars work behind the scenes. And basically, our customers pay us based on usage. So, you know, they're connecting end user email and calendars to our platform, and we bill them monthly according to, you know, how many accounts are connected to the platform. And so, you know, it's something that very much works in a sort of a complementary fashion where people come in the door, they tend to start small. You know, like we have a, like a very self-serve model for our platform where, you know, you can sign up, you're paying us like $30 a month in order to get the full power of the platform. And then as you grow and scale, you know, as your app gets users, you know, we get paid more as a part of powering that infrastructure. So, you know, we find that customers grow and expand in a very significant way over time. The product is very sticky because people are powering kind of core functionality to their applications through the Nylas platform. And then, you know, we really see it as like a long-term partnership between us and all the companies that are built on us. Like, we want to help those people basically keep up with all of the change that's happening out in the software world. There's so many demands on application developers these days. You have to connect to all sorts of different data sources. the user experience expectations of users are constantly changing. And basically you see like different generations of applications that kind of replace older generations. And if you don't want to get replaced, you have to rise to meet how these user expectations are changing over time. So it's our job to kind of track that high watermark of user expectations and provide the Lego blocks to all of our app developers so that they can really just kind of make sure that they're keeping pace and focus on whatever is the differentiator and kind of what their core customer base needs.
So obviously for building a company like this and to deliver this kind of experience that you guys are giving, you know, there's a requirement there or there's a need, you know, for capital too, no? Because it's capital intensive at least to build things and to get things going. So up until today, you guys have raised $175 million. So what has been the experience of going through the different financing cycles here?
Yeah, for sure. So the first money we ever raised was basically end of 2013. I mentioned, you know, it was a small seed round. It was like $2 million. And then we raised a bunch of different rounds throughout basically the last decade. The last one was our Series C, which was in 2021. It was a big round, $115 million. And you know, all that money that primarily has gone to power R&D and to sort of, you know, build the product. And it's definitely something that, you know, really changes over time, like depending on the round, like what is it require, you know, at the seed, at least in 2013, I think this is something that has changed over the past decade where I think at the seed level today, people expect to see some actual traction. In 2013, this was sort of like peak zero interest rate period where I think a lot of money was being deployed to just ideas because, you know, if you have a lot of capital in the system, like people are sort of more flexible on that. But at kind of the Series A, that's when sort of you need to have more of a demonstration of like there's demand for this product and we have a team that can execute. And then kind of in the later stages, it really becomes more all about the numbers, you know, like, are you growing? How fast are you growing? And then like, what are you going to sort of deploy this capital? Like you basically raise money so you can grow faster. And you got to have like a story for like, what are you going to do with this and a plan for like, why do you need to raise capital? You know, the goal at the end of the day on the investor side is like, I'm giving you money so you can turn it into more money. And I think there's like a few lessons that I've definitely taken away. One is that like investors really, you know, differ in terms of like what are their backgrounds. Some of them come from like Wall Street, PE. Some of them are like former operators. Like you got to kind of understand who you're talking to. And also just like, you know, it's a business pitch you're making, not a technology pitch. Like at the very early stages, you can probably get away with being like much more product focused and less about the business opportunity and have sort of more vagueness there. But like the further along you get, the more, you know, it needs to be around kind of the growing and the scaling of the business. And it's another thing that like you find out what works by, you know, actually pitching people. And so like for every round that we raised, always had like a spreadsheet, like a basically a VC CRM of like, here's all the people we're targeting. We split them up into basically tranches of like ABC of like people that we are comfortable going to early to refine the pitch. And then sort of people we are saving to be sort of more once we like felt like we really had like the story really dialed in. And then, you know, it's a sales process. So like creating a sense of competition, you know, is something that can help sort of maximize your outcome. And then I think just like another thing that I learned around fundraising is that like maximizing your valuation is like not always the thing that is like going to be the best thing for the company. Like you have to think about like, what are you going to be able to do with the capital that you've raised? And like, how far is it going to get your business? Because I think over the decade of 2010 to 2020, there is like very much this mindset of like the goal of raising money is to get you to your next round. And I think that's something that is changing today, where like often maybe the goal of raising money is so that we never have to raise again. So we get to a point of just like enough traction that like it's optional for us to raise money. And that level of discipline is something that like wasn't really there 10 years ago. And I think founders that are kind of raising money today, you should be like really laser focused on like, what do we need to do to like not be sort of stuck in this world where you kind of constantly need to sort of feed more capital into the machine, because expectations on the investor side have definitely changed. I think that like AI has won with sort of like a bimodal distribution of inputs. There's like these kind of like vertical applications that can grow really fast with like rather minimal capital inputs. And then there's sort of like these more hard tech AI applications that require ludicrous amounts of capital and that do grow really, really fast, but just have to raise tons of money. You know, people like sort of the core LLM model providers, folks like that. But, you know, it's always like a world that is changing. Like the sort of fundraising advice from 5 or 10 years ago is just like not a playbook that I would expect would work, you know, off the shelf today.
I hear you on that. Now, obviously, when investors are betting, you know, on a company, they are betting on a future, they're betting on a vision. So I guess if you had to go to sleep tonight, Christina, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Nylas is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Yeah, our vision really is to make people more productive, to help people get more done, and to allow them to spend more time working on things and doing things in their lives that are not, you know, sitting in front of a computer, you know, working at a CRM. And, you know, the way that we're doing that is by basically like modernizing all of these workflows that people have tended to do manually. You know, one of the first things that sort of people started building with Nylas was essentially like using us to pull email data into your CRM. Like original sort of CRM apps, when they first started being like, wow, we should have email conversation data in our CRM, they launched that functionality by having their end users basically BCC a special email address. But the problem with that was that it's half the time people forget, you end up with incomplete data. And if you don't have that complete data set, you basically can't build intelligence that is making use of the data, because it'll be a little wrong because some context is missing. And, you know, we want to make it so that all sort of like business productivity apps, people call them CRMs, people call them platforms, whatever, like the software that people are using to run companies, is able to be intelligent. It's able to provide contextual suggestions of what people should be doing. And the way that we do that is by providing this really rock solid access to the communications data. And then also sort of providing these building blocks for like, what are the workflows and things that people need to do with that data. And then people can get on with their lives, you know, go outside, touch grass, spend less time doing data entry.
Now, obviously here we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection, you know, because you've been at it now for, you know, about 12 years, you know, sort of speak, let's say over a decade for sure with the business. Now, if I was to put you into a time machine and I bring you back in time, you know, maybe that moment in 2013 where you were giving your notice at Oracle where you were working, and let's say you had the opportunity of having a chat with that younger Christine, that younger self, and you were able to give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
The biggest advice I would give to my younger self is really that like you have a lot of agency and you're better than you think you are, and like don't hide behind other people. You know, you're the reason that like a lot of people are going to show up to work at this company, and you have something special that you should be really proud of, and you shouldn't constantly feel like you're beating yourself up because you're not doing enough and you're not good enough. And like, it's okay to just like go out there and make mistakes and make decisions. Like, you're not going to get judged by it. You know, it's just a part of the journey.
I love it. Well, Christine, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You can email me. It's Spang, S-P-A-N-G, at nios.com. Or I'm also on the platform formerly known as Twitter. My handle is at Spang. At me. DM me. I would love to hear from you.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Yeah, it's been great to be here. It's super fun.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.